From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we hear from some of the people who are organizing the ongoing protests here in Milwaukee. Then the Milwaukee Public Library gives us a list of book recommendations for adults and kids to learn more about racism.
You know, I've had to, especially recently, have those tough conversations. And I found this book list to be helpful to me in explaining some of those things to my children.
Plus, we look at research that shows that even though parents say they want diverse schools, they often don't make it a priority.
Parents are at least reporting that they do in fact want integration, and our focus groups and interviews give us reason to believe that that's coming from an earnest place. But when they are making decisions about where actually to enroll their children, in many cases, they're letting other priorities come first.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Today marks the 26th consecutive day of marches in Milwaukee. The protests began after the death of George Floyd at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer. While Floyd's death was the catalyst, protesters say police brutality is not an isolated issue, and they want to see improvements here in Milwaukee. Organizers of Milwaukee's protests say they plan to continue marching, and they say they're motivated by a hope for change. WUWM's LaToya Dennis spoke to a group of organizers that call themselves the New Milwaukee. Khalil Coleman, Destiny Monet, and Mariah Smith talk about their goals for the protests. Smith starts by explaining why she got involved.
I just saw on Facebook that there was a march, and again, that was against the police brutality. It was right after George Floyd was murdered. So went down, and the feeling I got was something that I could never explain. I can't explain it to this day. And that was, I think we're on day 20 now, maybe. I'm gonna be honest with you, all the days are kind of meshing together, so I'm not sure which day we're on, but it was a feeling that I cannot explain to this day. So, and it was so empowering. I can't say that it was an empowering feeling. So walking with all different colors of people, all different races, all different walks of life, people that had money, people that were poor, people that were middle class, absolutely everybody. And everybody was there with the same agenda, which was justice. So with that being said, it was something that was kind of, it was addictive. Like, I didn't want to stop. I felt like, you know, if I stop, it's like, okay, I'm taking a step away. But keeping going is just the feeling that I got. I don't know how they really explain it, but the feeling that I got from that first day is what's kind of kept me going. And it's always been a message for justice, a message for equality. So that's why I'm still here, because we still don't have what we've been marching for.
Have you ever been involved with anything like this before?
No, I have not. That was actually the first protest I had ever walked in.
So why this one?
This one was a little different for me. This man, George Floyd, I'm going to say his name, George Floyd, he was calling out, begging for them to stop. Please get off of my neck. He wasn't aggressive. He wasn't resisting or any of that. And he was still killed. I forgot his name. He was selling, they suspected him of selling bootleg CDs. You know, he was fighting on the ground, but again, they were holding him down. And this just hit differently because he was laying there. You watched him screaming, to not responding at all, to them flipping his body over, and him being loose, just completely loose, lifeless. So that hit me hard. It hit me very, very hard. If somebody could do that with a camera on him, what other cops do we have doing this that don't have cameras on them? It's imperative that we have a change. It is a necessity that we have a change, because we have cops that literally do not care that they're being recorded. while murdering a man. So that's why this one hit me a bit harder. Well, hit me the hardest of them all.
Do you believe there are police officers locally with what you've described as the attitude of not caring?
That is across the board. We're, you know, we are marching with for Jay Anderson. We're marching for all of them here in Milwaukee.
Now, you just mentioned Jay Anderson, and I want to make sure that we're all on the same page. Now, Jay Anderson was killed by a white Wauwatosa police officer, Joseph Mensa. It was said that Anderson, who was black, was drunk and sleeping in his car in a park.
This officer, Joseph Mensa, he's been on duty for 5 years. He has 3 bodies, and he's fired his weapon 28 times. That's what y'all go through training for. You can use a taser. You can use your little stick, whatever it's called. And there are still injustices happening. It's not just stuff we're seeing on TV. These are things that we are seeing on a daily here. So these officers need to resign as well. Just like in Menominee Falls, somebody, the village, the lady that's on the village, they asked her, somebody wrote her in a group chat and asked her, hey, I just heard gunshots over by the police station. Is everything okay? And she said, practicing for the rally on Saturday. What type of mess is that? And this is kids walking. And even if it wasn't kids walking, even if it was grown men, they're peacefully protesting. So how can you, as a village representative, say that, consciously say that? And yeah, so there's a problem throughout the globe. That's why this is a global protest, because there's problems throughout the world with this, not just Minneapolis.
Now, Destiny Monet, I'm coming to you now, and I'm going to ask you that same question. Why get involved?
I just couldn't stand to sit on my phone on social media and talk about it. I wanted to do something. So as soon as I seen it was a march going on in my city, I had to be a part of it. I went down to 27th and Center, and I just saw a bunch of people out there chanting, walking with their signs, and I really felt like I belonged there. And Mariah was talking on, she spoke on the feeling that you get. It's like an overwhelming feeling of love, support, and it's addicting, like she said, and just seeing us all come together as a unified group. It's kind of like showing me what the world could be. How, you know, going through neighborhoods that I hate to say we don't belong in, but that's just how Milwaukee is set up. Being able to walk through neighborhoods that I don't belong in with our white allies, that was great because I finally feel supported. We're yelling Black Lives Matter. We're not trying to convince you that. We have people agreeing with us that say Black Lives Matter. And I just wanted to help with being the change. So I feel like it was essential for me to join in with the movement and make something happen instead of just talking about it.
Have you ever been involved with anything like this before?
No, ma'am. This is my first protest, my very first one. I don't know where I've been all these years, but this is my very first one.
And Khalil, what about you? You're not new to this at all, I know. But why this time? Why now?
I had took a break for a minute, you know, after, you know, the Derrick Williams, and then right after Derrick Williams, you know what I'm saying, you know, we had the Dontre Hamilton, you know, then I was out there in St. Louis and Baltimore, and it was like real, it was just real heavy. So I ended up just kind of like falling back. But then when I seen the video and like other videos have popped up before and like, of course, other things that happened before, but it really didn't tug at my spirit like that until I seen George Floyd video. And it was just something about the police, like just confidently like standing on that man's neck. And watching George Floyd like take his last breath, like it really bothered me. Like that's why now. You know what I'm saying? That's what made me get back out here again, because, you know, then I ended up going to Minnesota and you know, just kind of being in the spirit, you know what I'm saying, like with the community. Like that's what I needed. Like for me, that's what I needed again. You know what I'm saying? To kind of spark my flame, you know what I'm saying, of activism. you know, and to, you know, transition some of the energy that that I felt was left undone, you know what I'm saying, in previous times, in previous marches, you know. So for me, that's what sparked, you know, my feet on the ground, you know what I'm saying, and my walking, you know what I'm saying, at this particular moment.
Now, you talk about things that were left undone from previous marches, previous protests. What are some of those things you're alluding to?
See, justice, y'all, is you know, a lot of cops, man, you know, even previously, you know, just kind of looking at the Derek Williams case, you know, we marched every Sunday for a whole year before they even decided to do a federal inquiry where they had, you know, came, got this federal judge who had retired and got him off the bench. And hey, he came in, they worked with the federal government. And then, the whole time, like, they covered up, you know what I'm saying, the death of Derrick Williams. You know, then they started talking about failure to render aid, and they charged the cops with failure to render aid, but none of them went to jail. You know, and all the cops went up there and pleaded the fifth. So, like, you know, when you talk about a police officer's accountability when they break the law or when they break standard operating procedures and they, you know, go on administrative leave with pay, you know what I'm saying, or they get, you know, fired from the job but they never face criminal charges, like, those are injustices, you know, because it makes a system higher than the people. You know, and I think that's what I talk when I say, like, stuff undone. Like, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about families who cry because they lost loved ones. Like, people, you know what I'm saying, you know, who put their life on the line, you know what I'm saying, for protesting. People who've been to jail, like, even people who've been killed out in St. Louis. Like, it was activists who was murdered, you know what I'm saying, burned alive in a car. You know what I'm saying, like, 2-3 years later after the St. Louis and Ferguson uprising. But they don't talk about that. You know what I'm saying? So, like, it's a lot of people, it's people who put sacrifice in, you know what I'm saying, that still never got justice. So that's what's undone. You know what I'm saying? The system change is what's undone.
What does justice look like for you guys? Khalil, you take that first.
Man, a place where I ain't got to worry about my son having to go through the same thing that I go through. I think I want to see a free world. Like, I want to see a world where not like where color don't matter, because, like, I'm proud to be black, you know, but I want to be proud to be black in the world where, like, black is accepted. I know when it happened, it will be a feeling that I feel. You know what I'm saying? I know I just don't feel like feeling right now. So I know justice isn't something that I can say, I reached justice. Like, I know that's not something that I can say right now.
Destiny Monet, what does justice look like for you?
I feel like if a penalty for any crime is 5 years for a white man, it should be 5 years for a black man. If it's life for a black man, it should be life for a Hispanic man, for an Asian man. It just needs to be equal. It shouldn't be situational with black people and white people. Law enforcement should be held accountable for all that they do. There shouldn't be, oh, he got off. Like, that don't make sense to me. He got off what? I think that taxpaying citizens and law enforcement should experience the same things as far as breaking rules. We all need to have the same exact consequences. I feel like when it comes to law enforcement, we should be safe. Like, with our protests, why aren't the cops protecting us the way they are protecting racist people? And then they have on riot gear. I'm not understanding that. If we are peaceful and it's someone who is making jokes about harming us, why do they have more safety than we do? I just need things to be equal. If you're going to protect the races, I need you to protect me as well. I shouldn't feel like I can only go in certain neighborhoods when I'm protesting. I shouldn't be afraid when I'm pulled over by the police, whether I'm speeding or whether I'm just being black. I should be comfortable with reaching for my ID. I shouldn't have to announce it. If you ask me for my license and registration, I should be able to reach for that versus telling you, okay, it's in the glove box. I'm going to reach for it now. It's just certain things with the justice system that are against us. And if we were given the same equal opportunities, we wouldn't have to fight as long or as hard for equality. So justice is pretty much equality across the board and accountability for those who do wrong, not just us.
And Mariah, what about you?
Being pulled over. I should not start to sweat bullets when I see red and blue lights behind me. They're meant to protect me. So why are my hands sweating? Why do I all of a sudden start to get anxiety when somebody who took an oath to protect and serve me, my people, and everybody, my people is everybody. Why am I nervous? Why am I scared? Why am I scared for my brother to be pulled over? He had a nice car, tinted windows. We made him get his car, made him untint his windows because of your young black man. And a cop will say he felt threatened coming, walking up to your car. So the fact that we kind of have to teach our kids how to speak to cops, how to behave with cops, how to say, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, no, sir, no, ma'am. The fact that we kind of got to teach our babies before they are 10, hey, when you come in contact with a cop, you come in contact with an officer, you need to speak very properly. You need to make sure your hands are shown. They can see, but that is not equality, because I know for a fact, my white friends that I have, that I had through high school, none of their parents were worried about them going out and coming back home. Not one of them. That's justice for me, when we all are equal. George Floyd may have had a fraudulent check or a counterfeit $10 bill and is murdered. That's not justice. It has to be equal. That's how we get justice. When people are charged for what they did, not based off of, oh, I know you're 17 and you have a life ahead of you. A 17-year-old black boy, he looks like a thug. And a 17-year-old white boy, he looks, oh, he has a future ahead of him. So we're going to give you a slap on the wrist. But black boy gets 3 years in jail, and now he's a felon. Now y'all ruined his life. Now he can't vote. He can't even vote for the things that he wants to change. Yeah, he made a mistake when he was 17, but he's 21 now. Why can't he vote? So things of that nature, they set it for our people to not be able to succeed. So the whole I'm being honest, it's the whole system. The whole system needs to be reset for everybody to be able to succeed, not just people that are not of color.
How many miles are you guys logging a day?
I think one day we did 9. I'm pretty sure, Khalil, we just walked 9 the other day.
How are your feet holding up, guys?
Blistered.
what's the end game here? It seems like people are willing to come to the table at this point.
Yep, that's what we want. But that's not, you know what I'm saying? That's not the end goal. You know what I'm saying? That's just the beginning. You know what I'm saying? Like that, you know, the fact that people want to come to the table, the fact that people want to introduce change in legislation, the fact that people want to have the conversation is a beautiful thing, but that's not the end goal. You know, the end goal is a change to the system as we currently know it to be. You know, as I was hearing on a phone call earlier with a state representative who also is connected with D.C., you know, when we talk about the change of justice and when we talk about changing systems of oppression, we have to talk about changing police as we know it to be in America. You know, and that requires policing to be different. That's the end goal. You know what I'm saying? You know, not just resolution being introduced that's redundant, you know, and repetitive, but accountability as well, bark with a bite. You know, that's what we want to see. But at the same time, you know, we don't want to compromise that for losing the momentum of the people, you know, because there's still a lot of people that need to be woke up. There's still a lot of communities that need to hear Black Lives Matter. You know what I'm saying? And like, we're not a Black Lives Matter group. We ain't funded by the Black Lives Matter National or none of that. You know what I'm saying? Like, we just believe and already know our lives mattered from day one. So, you know what I'm saying? This is people taking to the street, and then any allies white, black, brown, you know what I'm saying? They join the street, you know what I'm saying? And it becomes a people movement. You know what I'm saying? We're not pushing anybody to the side and or hating on any other, you know what I'm saying, gender, race, creed, ethnicity, sexuality, or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Because if we all coming for the cause of justice, then you got to look at the people who the most oppressed in the country and start with them. And black people has been the most oppressed in America. So we start with Black Lives Matter, because when we change that, then we change it for everybody. You know what I'm saying? Then we can go to ICE and look at ICE. You know what I'm saying? We can go to, you know, XYZ. But, you know, and until we stop trying to overshadow Black Lives Matter with All Lives Matter, because we're not saying that all lives don't matter. But what we're saying is all lives can't matter until Black Lives Matter is included with those all lives. We want to keep the momentum going. You know what I'm saying? Come to the table. We can talk. We can have conversations. We want to go back and we want to change legislation and introduce legislation and make amendments to legislation. But that's not the end goal. The end goal is people having power. You know what I'm saying? The end goal is people knowing their rights. The end goal is people knowing what they can and cannot, you know what I'm saying, do in a system, you know what I'm saying, that's designed to be for the people. When you say liberty and justice for all, you know, that's really what we want to see.
So what makes this time different? We've seen protests here over these issues before. You've even led them, Khalil. So why is this time different?
Traffic. I love it. I love the traffic. You know what I'm saying? The first 3 days, 4 days, it was original. It was organic. It was people from the community. Like, everybody was out there. You know, you seen, I think somebody made an analogy, like, you seen the church guy walking with the hood brother, you know what I'm saying? You seen LGBTQ with the straight. You seen, you know what I'm saying? Like, you see people from all different walks of life, you know what I'm saying, out here in the movement. And that's what make it different. This time, it ain't a separation thing. It ain't a, oh, that's just a black cause right now. And yeah, it's a black movement, but everybody is being involved and everybody feel like, okay, like things ain't right. So, you know, people taking to the street off of that alone, like, okay, yeah, you know, regardless if you, you know, yeah, it's happening to black people, you know what I'm saying, drastically, but we know that it ain't right. And I think that's what people standing on, like, it ain't right. And that's what makes it different. You know what I'm saying? The fact that you got people walking in the street for miles in traffic, sometimes hundreds of cars is behind them. You know what I'm saying? Stand in line, stand in order with the people as they walk. That's what's making this different, you know? And it ain't like the civil rights movement where it was just the churches and everybody, you know, walking, you know what I'm saying, you know, collectively. Like, you got the whole, like, you got a whole shebang of people involved, and that's what make it the people's movement.
That was Khalil Coleman, Mariah Smith, and Destiny Monet. They're all protest organizers who are part of the group The New Milwaukee. They spoke with WUWM's LaToya Dennis. Coming up, Hermione Bell Henderson from the Milwaukee Public Library joins us with a list of book recommendations that teach readers more about race and racism. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Right now, many of us are engaging in conversations about race and systemic racism in the United States. In some ways, it's a conversation our country has been having for generations. But our nation's legacy of racial injustice is often obscured by history books. That's left some people asking, how did we get here? And how can I learn more? The answer to that last question is books. Hermione Bell Henderson is the coordinator of business, technology, and periodicals at the Milwaukee Public Library, and she's compiled a list of books to help adults and kids learn more about racism, racial injustice, and how to be a part of social change. She joins me now to talk about her selections. Hermione Bell Henderson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've compiled a list of books here that are a good resource for people who are just getting into this topic.
Absolutely. These are all resources that can be accessed at the Milwaukee Public Library. And it's like no better time than now to focus on what's going on in the world.
So this first title, very blunt and probably a good starting off point for people. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Sure. So the first book is So You Want to Talk About Race by Ijeoma Alu. And it's really a book that focuses on the issues of Black America. It addresses everything head on and discusses topics such as privilege, police brutality, microaggressions, the popular Black Lives Matter movement, and even the N-word. It does so in a very raw and brutally honest way, and it really just gets you thinking about race.
Well, it sounds like something that unpacks a lot of the terms that we're hearing in a lot of different news reports and a lot of different commentators. When they say certain terms, I think some people just, you know, they don't have the education to really understand what's being talked about. And the next title that you have is actually, I would say, one of those phrases. White Fragility is the title of the next book.
Right. So the next title is White Fragility: Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism by Robin J. DiAngelo. And what is white fragility? It's really characterized by white people becoming uncomfortable when they are challenged with the topic of race. It focuses on the emotions of anger and fear and guilt. And there's kind of, you know, the two sides of what happens when you have an uncomfortable conversation. You know, you might get defensive and start arguing, but then the other side of that is that you might just go plain silent. And so it really examines whiteness and gives people an opportunity to change for the better and talk about what's uncomfortable and really have those meaningful conversations about race. It also allows people to really disrupt their beliefs, their principles, and just patterns that have been developed over time, not only in their own lives, but through history when talking about race.
So in that same vein, the next title, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Tell us a bit about that.
Sure. So Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America by Michael Eric Dyson is a title by a Black voice, who's been discussing race topics for a very long time. Tears We Cannot Stop really focuses on Black reality. It focuses on facing the difficult truths about what it's like to be Black in America, and really addresses how long that Black reality has really just been ignored, dismissed, and discounted here in America. It gives us a better understanding of the world that we live in, and that if we actually do face reality and the difficult truths of what it means to be Black in America, we can really go deeper and begin to take action to address finally what needs to be addressed.
Now, this next book, it has actually a local tie, and I think people will be familiar with the author James Cameron as the founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum. This is an interesting title in part because it's such a personal story.
Correct. So James Cameron, in his book, A Time of Terror, A Survivor's Story, really gives that first person account of his 1930 arrest. At the time, he was 16 years old and he was out with his friends, and a mob got them and terrorized them and lynched his two friends. And he was nearly lynched, but he was fortunately able to escape. It's a very powerful story. And later in life, James Cameron went on to, again, like you said, become the founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum and really tell his story as a civil rights activist. So, you know, it wasn't too long ago. And for him to be able to share his story before he died, again, was very powerful.
And for people who might not be familiar with this incident that happened, it actually is a very famous photograph, the photograph of his two friends who were lynched. And it inspired a very big song, Strange Fruit.
Yes, it did. Very inspiring.
Yeah. So this next book, perhaps aptly after talking about A Time of Terror, is called Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption.
So Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption by Brian Stevenson has really grown in popularity, especially since the movie is out. It really gives you that great visual representation of the book. The movie now features Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Foxx, but the story is the true story of Walter McMillan, who was convicted and sentenced for a crime that he didn't even commit. And so Brian Stevenson was the lawyer, and he's a very influential lawyer who's behind the Equal Justice Initiative that has exonerated innocent death row prisoners. I believe at the time of this and just the current work of the Equal Justice Initiative, they have freed over 135 wrongly condemned prisoners on death row. But the story of Walter McMillan really just sheds light and is one of many true stories that highlights racism and our broken justice system.
Yeah. Now, this next book, I have to say, I really enjoy the title, in part because I think, you know, as somebody who is a white person in America and who grew up in a predominantly white area, sometimes, you're just a little stupid about things. You're just a little ignorant about things. And I like that the title is How to Be Less Stupid About Race. Like, you're still going to be a little stupid about it, but let's be less so.
Right. I picked the title just because it was a little fun, even though it is a heavy topic. But Crystal Fleming, the author, really gets down to helping us understand the historical roots of white supremacy, helps us draw connections between, you know, past racism and present racism. And then at the end, she is able to help offer 10 steps to help dismantle systemic racism. So a deep topic, nice and light title.
Well, and with that in mind, one of the things that we wanted to do inside of this list was include titles that would be accessible for teens and even children. And the next few titles, I'll speak to a younger age group.
Correct. I know as a mom of two Black kids here in Milwaukee's, you know, the most segregated city in the nation. You know, I've had to, especially recently, have those tough conversations. And I found this book list to be helpful to me in explaining some of those things to my children. The first one is Not My Idea, a book about whiteness by Anastasia Higginbotham. And it's the story of a white child who sees a TV news report of a white police officer shooting and killing a Black man. And they talk about, the mom says, hey, in our family, we don't see color. But the child sees the colors, very plain and simple. And so the story talks about uncovering the truth of white supremacy in America. But it's tailored very nicely because it's a book that's geared toward ages 5 through 12. So it goes deep, but it's still simple enough for the youngest readers.
Now, this next title is pretty blunt. Racism and Intolerance. Is that an overview more for children?
Yes, it is, I would say. So Racism and Intolerance by Louise Spilsbury really helps children get answers to the questions like, what does it mean to be a racist? Or what does it mean to be intolerant? And then how can I help? So children begin to understand the ways that others struggle with these issues. Everyone who reads these titles or this book can, you know, start to or become empowered to make a difference. So it's also a call for action for our young readers.
Now, this next title called Let's Talk About Race, it seems like a good, again, kind of an introduction for kids.
Right. So Let's Talk About Race by Julius Lester talks about race, but in poetic form. So it's a nice poetic introduction to the topic of race. There's a discussion about differences and unique features of races that can be celebrated while also discussing the important bond that everyone shares with one another. And then there's also discussion of, you know, we are bonded because we're human beings and, you know, we have many common similarities. So a great discussion that's geared more toward ages 6 and up. So again, a very good read for the young children.
Well, in this next title on the same idea of poetry is Say Her Name, Poems to Empower. What I like about this title is I think sometimes when we talk about topics that are as serious as racism, intolerance, racial discrimination, we can tend to lean away from the artistry of writing that I think often pulls people in. We tend to lean on nonfiction for very obvious reasons, but I like that this includes some of the artistic part of this dialogue.
Right. So Say Her Name, Poems to Empower by Zeta Elliott focuses on 49 poems, and some of the poets who contributed to this were inspired by the greats. So Nikki Giovanni or Phyllis Wheatley or Lucille Clifton. This book was also inspired by the Say Her Name campaign. So they pay tribute to victims of police brutality in a very uplifting kind of way, with themes talking about self-love, Black resistance. It helps people and readers peek into the mind of what's it like to be a Black woman in America. And, you know, we hear through the protests and we hear through, you know, all these stories of police brutality that, you know, don't forget our Black women. So that's very important to shed some light and focus on Black women who are also going through the same things here in America. I like this book because it offers messages of hope and resilience to young readers. Like you said, also in a very creative format. So, you know, when we think of our young readers, we think about them wanting to express themselves in their own creative ways. So hopefully this type of book and poetry form will also inspire young poets as well.
Yeah. Well, Hermione, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much again for having me. I appreciate it.
Hermione Bell Henderson is the coordinator of business, technology, and periodicals at the Milwaukee Public Library. Although access to public libraries is limited due to the pandemic, there are still a number of ways to access their books. You can head to mpl.org for more information about how to get your hands on some of these books. We'll take a short break now, then learn about a study that looks at how parents prioritize school integration. Lake Effect will return in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction has released guidance for how schools can safely resume in-person classes this fall.
And we know that school is going to look a lot different for kids. But one thing that hasn't changed is that in Wisconsin, parents have a lot of choices about where to send their children to school. Open enrollment allows families to switch between public school districts. And parental choice programs let some families enroll in private schools using taxpayer-funded vouchers. Research from the Harvard University Graduate School of Education sheds light on the relationship between parental choice and school integration. Richard Weisbord and Eric Torres surveyed more than 2,000 parents across the country and conducted focus groups. They determined that even though most parents favor racially diverse schools, that often doesn't translate into action. Back in February, the researchers spoke with WUWM education reporter Emily Files about their report titled, Do Parents Really Want School Integration?
We got interested in school integration for a number of reasons. One is that we were worried about how fractured and divided the country is. We were worried that we are becoming, in many regions of the country, more segregated. We subscribe to what Thurgood Marshall has said, which is that if children don't know how to learn together, they won't know how to live together as adults. And so, when you look at the legal environment, it's disfavoring school integration. So it became clear that if we are going to make progress in school integration, that school districts and parents have a big role to play.
And can you just explain real briefly why the legal landscape is not favorable to school integration?
Well, there've been a number of court cases over the last decade or two that have not favored school integration. And the courts are becoming, since Trump was elected, the Supreme Court, other courts have become more conservative and less likely to support integration.
And give me a brief overview of the current state of school segregation in the U.S.
The answer is complicated, and it's complicated because there are rural areas in the country, for example, where there are more immigrant students than there have been in the past, so those schools are becoming more integrated. But, around 40% of students, Black and Latina students, are in hyper-segregated schools that over 90% on Black and Latino-Latina students. And, large numbers of white students continue to be in highly segregated schools as well.
Right. So 40% of Black and Latino students are in hyper-segregated schools, and that would include many Milwaukee schools as well. So one of the main questions you're trying to answer in this report is, do parents want school integration? Eric, what answer did you come up with?
So this question winds up being somewhat complicated, and that's sort of like the thorny issue that the report tries to investigate. On one hand, I think it's clear that they do. We see high levels of support for school integration across race, class, culture, and political difference. In principle, parents are expressing that they want integration, and when they're asked about the levels of integration that they would ideally prefer for their students, there's a consensus around high levels of integration as well. However, from other research, we know that in landscapes where parents have unrestricted school choice, the schools tend to become more segregated and not less, which provides some evidence that, in fact, maybe while they say that they want school integration, it's not enough to get them making integrative choices. Our report also has some other findings that sort of help flesh that out, which is that parents don't tend to prioritize integration above certain other concerns, namely the safety of schools and what they perceive as the academic quality of those schools. And so depending on what we mean by the notion of wanting integration, I think it's rather clear that parents are at least reporting that they do in fact want integration. And I think our focus groups and interviews give us reason to believe that that's coming from an earnest place. But when they are making decisions about where actually to enroll their children, in many cases, they're letting other priorities come first.
So there already is research out there about in school districts where there is a lot of choice, unrestricted school choice, that those schools tend to become more segregated, not less. The new research that you guys worked on for this report was this huge survey asking parents about their level of support for school integration by race and by income. Can you talk about the survey methods and what some of the numbers were?
It was a large national survey. We talked to people of all sort of like races, socioeconomic statuses, political orientation. We asked people about their preferences related to school integration. We asked them a variety of scenarios about conditions under which they would or wouldn't send their children to integrated schools. We asked them to rank their priorities. And then we also conducted focus groups and interviews in which we tried to dig into parents' thinking a little bit more deeply, ask them about how they were thinking about this in their own lives, what sort of factors led to the school enrollment decisions that they were making with their children.
What you found was high levels of support, especially for racial integration among pretty much every group of people.
Yep. I mean, there was variation among different demographics, but I think the general takeaway is that we saw high levels of support for racial integration and also somewhat smaller, but also generally high levels of support for socioeconomic integration as well. We saw that there were some parents who were ranking integration very highly among their priorities for schools that they choose for their children. But on average, most parents were ranking things like academic performance and safety concerns higher than integration, which helps to paint this picture of the psychological landscape and the preferences that parents are bringing to school choice.
Right. So even though your survey found that when you ask parents, do you support school integration, most of them said yes. When you asked, what are the most important factors that you look for in a school, integration was not one of the top three for most people. Instead, it was
not one of the top three for most people. That's correct.
Instead, it was academic quality and safety. So why might those priorities work against integration?
There are parents who really do want integrated schools, but they're getting distorted information about school quality and safety. And, you know, looking at average test scores at a school is not a good stand-in, is not a good proxy for school integration. White advantage parents are looking at the number of other white advantage parents at a school as a stand-in for integration, and that's not a good proxy for integration either. You know, lots of people don't have good information about what the culture of the school is like, whether students are engaged or not. So, you know, integration tends not to happen, even though parents want it in principle. I mean, the other thing that I think is going on is that white advantage parents tend to talk about parents who are in their bubble. So they tend to talk to other white advantage parents and don't really get diverse perspectives. So, you know, we're really making the case that not that every parent needs to send their child to an integrated school. You know, these are can be very tough decisions and complex decisions. But the parents should at least try to make it work because it's important for their own children. It's important for other people's children. And it's important for democracy and for the country. It's vital for the country. And so they should try to make it work if they can. And sometimes that really means doing some research and getting beyond the websites and getting beyond your insular group and really gathering information and checking your biases.
You mentioned in the report that when parents are making decisions about schools, they might look at data points like school report cards. In Wisconsin, though, the school report cards now factor in student growth more heavily. But you're saying that in some cases, the school report cards might be mostly looking at the test scores of a school and that's going to skew towards a more advantaged population, and then it's kind of a compounding effect.
I think that even over and above looking into the data on school performance, though, I think the case that we're making is that it's important for parents to actually get outside of their circles, to take school tours rather than relying on sort of reputations or rumors that might largely bounce around echo chambers of similar and similarly minded parents. So even in the cases that you have a lot of data available to you, I think there's more to do to get beyond some of the biases and misconceptions that can skew parents' perceptions of given schools.
From this report and what you learned from this research that you did and the other research that's out there about how intentions don't necessarily translate into action when it comes to school integration, do you think that this means that school districts, if they really want integrated schools, need to limit parental choice?
No, I think that what it means is that parents, that school districts need to couple parental choice, which I think is a good thing, with information campaigns. I mean, really giving parents access to really good information about integrated schools. I also think that part of the issue is thoughtfully integrating schools. It's not just throwing kids together. It's integrating schools in ways that are constructive for all kids, you know, where there are constructive conversations about race and teachers who are really prepared to lead those conversations. You know, our hope is that school districts can still give parents choices, but that they engage in campaigns where they lift up the strengths of many different schools, encourage parents to actually do school tours, which some research suggests can change parents' decisions about a school. So I think there's a lot of public information, public education that needs to happen here. I also think school districts could create forums for parents to talk to other parents who are outside their bubble. And, you know, that would be a good thing to do. I mean, there are just a lot of things I think districts could do that wouldn't be too expensive that might help with this.
There is this really fundamental issue in education where there is research that shows that integration is good for all students and socially and academically, especially for students of color, there are benefits. But it is such a personal decision for each family.
Yeah. And that's also something we wanted to emphasize, is that this is a personal decision for every family. And it's a complex decision. It's often a really complex decision. And you certainly have to think about your particular child and how your individual child learns, and the challenges that your individual child might have in different environments. But we are also saying that one important factor in your thinking should be, and an important factor, whether or not you can send your kid to an integrated school. I mean, that should be one priority. And because of the research suggesting that it's going to have advantages for your kids, it's going to have advantages for other kids, and because it's so critical to democracy in our country.
Richard Weisbord is director of the Making Caring Common Project, and Eric Torres is a PhD student at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. They spoke with WUWM's Emily Files in February. We have a link to the full study at our website, wuwm.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.